Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today it's a pleasure to have as my guest Carol Muskie Dukes, whose new novel, Life After Death, was just published by Random House. I am as fond of Carol Muskie Dukes' novels as I am of Carol Muskie's poetry. They are one and the same person. Her novels are Dear Digby, Saving St. Germ, and Now Life After Death. The books of poetry include Camouflage, Skylight, Windmere, Applause, Red Trousseau, most recently An Octave Above Thunder, and a book of essays called Women in Poetry, Truth, Autobiography, and the Shape of the Self, came out around the same time as her last book of poems. But now we have her novel, Life After Death, which comes into the world with a most strange, painful, and remarkable form of enunciation. In the first chapter of this novel, a woman, Boyd, infuriated by her husband's negligence with their daughter, tells him that she wishes he would die. And he does. Just before the book was published, Carol Muskie Dukes' husband died on a tennis court, also the victim of a heart attack. And I wanted to address right away not the personal issue, which seems to me not our business, but the effects of writing on life itself and the way in which it seems to me that a writer's inner ear is always hearing the possibilities of the future. How did you work with having written essentially a version of your husband's death?
Well, I think that I'm so split, obviously, in my response to this, because at first I was horrified, absolutely horrified. After the evening I got the phone call that my husband had died on a tennis court, up in Washington State, where he had been shooting a miniseries, I couldn't think of anything. I mean, I was in shock. And then sometime during that first dreadful night, I realized that I thought of the book that I had just completed, the novel that had just gone back to Random House that day after final copy editing. And I was horrified, as I said, and I thought, I can't bear this. I can't possibly live with this book in the world, because the coincidence is so so dramatic and seemingly so, seems so prophetic, and in a way it points to a kind of prescience that I don't want to lay claim to. Anyway, I decided to publish the book, and I decided that I would go ahead and sort of face whatever response to that coincidence came my way. Since then, I've gotten more philosophical about it, and I really am sort of looking forward to talking about it, because I feel now that there are a number, it's not really a version of my husband's death, there are a number of other things that flow into the mix. Among them, what you mentioned about a writer's sense of the world in writing. I want to back up just a little bit and say that my husband, who was an actor named David Dukes, had no history of heart disease that we knew of. He looked to be an extremely healthy man, and we had no idea that he had advanced coronary artery disease. The character in the novel, Russell Schaefer, also has advanced coronary artery disease. However, there is, I mean, obviously this is not, and he does die in a tennis court, as you said. He succumbs to, you know, he has a heart attack. But he precipitates his own death. He helps his own death along for reasons that the book reveals. Russell, the character, wants to die, essentially. My husband did not want to die. This seems like a major difference. But also Russell takes digitalis, which is a medication that will speed the heart to sort of help enhance the danger of this kind of extreme cardiovascular activity, knowing his condition, which my husband did not. And then he essentially pretty much commits suicide, this character. So there is that difference. But getting back to the idea of writing and what we do when we write, if we do anything at all or if we receive information, I just like to say that I don't think writers are prescient. I don't think we see into the future. I don't think that we have crystal balls or that we are psychic. I do, however, think that writers, it's our job in a way to interpret the present, to be so attuned to the present, that in a sense, knowing so fully what the present is, understanding the present, one can in fact seem to predict a kind of future or seem to have powers of divination. I guess I would even go a little further with that. In my case, for example, I might have had inklings of, you know, possible signs, in quotes, that my husband wasn't perfectly healthy, but instead of, you know, pushing him out the door to the emergency room, perhaps, I'm just speculating about this, I took those questions into art, perhaps. You know, I think that may be true, and I can't ever really know, but I think that that part of it may be true.
Now, I want to suggest, in fact, that this book, Life After Death, by my guest, Carol Muskie Dukes, has, in fact, nothing to do with her husband's death, and that, on the other hand, it's a writer's nature, especially a writer who is also a poet, to choose materials at their most volatile, and that the subject of this book is birth and death, and death and rebirth, as the title has it, Life After Death. The character in the book is named Boyd. She was a registered but never practicing doctor, obstetrician.
Right.
And after a death during her residency of a woman in the midst of an abortion, she decides not to practice, although the death is not laid at her door in any sense. She marries a wealthy man and essentially disappears from the life that she'd been living, hoping, I think, to disappear in a sense into him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's with his death, which happens in the very first chapter, that she enters the possibilities available to her and to her own life. And it is her exploration of life and death and her options within both that is the subject of the book.
That's exactly right, Michael. Once again, you have summed it up and you win the prize. No, but that's right. Yes, I would argue for that truth, that in fact I don't think my husband's death ultimately had anything to do with, except for what we just talked about, you know, sort of picking up of clues and quotes from one's everyday life. It has nothing to do with, say, Boyd or Russell. And Boyd is a character who came out of, for me anyway, satire, what was originally supposed to be a satire. I was trying to write, in my puny way, a kind of send-up of the loved one. Not a send-up of the loved one, but kind of something, you know, inspired by the loved one. I wanted to have a Joy Boy character, which is where one of my characters, Mr. Griggs, comes from. But I found that in doing research about the funeral industry and in general about my characters, that I realized it could not be a satirical book. And when Boyd became more fully fleshed in a way as a character, I understood that she was somebody else entirely. She was not going to be a character who would function as either a sort of conventional heroine, feminist or not, or a funny, smart-ass kind of character. For example, the kind of character I put together for my second book, The Scientist in Saving St. Germ, she was someone else entirely. Pretty much, as you point out, because the death takes place so early in the book, pretty much throughout the book, she is mad with grief. She's grieving and mad, literally. I mean, people pointed out she's not a very likable character, and she's not. I mean, she's pretty deranged by the fact that she has lost someone, and there's this sort of shadow on the death of a previous death, and that she's caught between two deaths, essentially.
Now, this is the second time that you've taken a major darkly comic novel as an inspiration point. Dear Bit Digby, Carol Muskie Dukes, my guest's first novel, took as its inspiration Miss Lonely Hearts, the story of a advice columnist who becomes involved in the horrific and finally unfunny and dire lives of very desperate sufferers. This book, as you said, was inspired by Evelyn Waugh's famous, well, it began by Waugh visiting the famous Hollywood graveyard cemetery, Forest Lawn, is it?
Yes, Forest Lawn,
yes. Yeah. What is it that has led you to start your books, embed your books in really bleak comedy, apocalyptic bleak comedy?
You know, I don't really know the answer, but I think probably the answer has something to do with the fact that I don't think of myself as a novelist. I think of myself as a poet. And so when I first tried to write a novel, I thought I would turn to something, not just a masterpiece, obviously, in the case of Nathaniel West, but something that I thought might be more available to me, that is to say, humor, because I'm sort of a funny person. You might not know it, but I sort of, you know, indulge in the sense of myself. And I thought, well, I could maybe make this work if I can use as my inspiration a book which has this, as you point out, both bitter and relieving comic thrust, you know, that it allows people to both laugh and feel great pain. And beyond that, that's what I admire a great deal. I think I admire West tremendously. I feel there's no relief from that vision ultimately, but I feel that the comedy makes him more heroic. I believe that a sense of humor makes one more heroic.
Because what I felt, you bring to this book more than your poetry is a ruthlessness that counterpoints the humanity and compassionate feeling, that the surprise of life after death consistently is that here is this woman who knows she's supposed to be a grieving widow but can't feel like a grieving widow because she's sort of relieved that she's out of her husband's web of charm.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that she has a... I don't want to... Well, I guess who cares about the plot of the book, but there's a moment in which she realizes that she loved him deeply and that when she's talking to Griggs, and that she is finally able to touch that place in herself, to open up that place in herself that will allow her to really acknowledge the loss. Prior to that, she's been fighting against it, which is... I don't know how accurate it is. Everybody grieves differently, but she's been really resisting, and not only resisting, she's been actively battling the idea of his death through refusal to accept, you know, a lot of things about it that have to do with, you know, her own profession in some ways. She knows that he died under strange circumstances, and she can't quite find out what happened because her mother-in-law is, on one hand, keeping information from her, and blah, 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 and so on. And, of course, the fact that his death brings up this earlier death, the loss of the woman during the abortion procedure. So she is, I suppose you would say, in a state of major denial in the first part of the book.
Well, I think that the book is in something of a state of denial as well, as follows. Carol Muskie Dukes, who knows that she's a very funny person, is writing a book that she also knows is about her protagonist's rebirth, almost literally so. She goes underground into a set of caves. She emerges again. And I think that the idea of writing a book in which someone re-wins access to her own life and her own destiny worries you, that you didn't want to write a sentimental novel or a novel of easy triumph.
Right.
And so the book pretends for the longest time that these emotional revelations are not going to occur, that we're dealing with a very tough cookie and a death comedy with grotesques, but really the inner structure of this book is about human growth.
Right.
And the comic structure is protecting the writer from knowing too much about what she's doing in that regard.
I don't know if this is an answer, but I think that I don't mean to say that I was glib in writing about death, but I think that what you, in a way, hinted at here is that the carryover from the satire, that is to say the elements of the novel, which are still conversant with an idea of the loved one, let's say, are to some degree at odds with the real progress or the real journey of the main character. And I don't mean that it's a, I hope I'm not, you know, bad-mouthing my own book, but I think that there is a certain collision which is disturbing between those two elements, you know, between the, you know, the kind of satire, grotesquery, as you say, and this very, this terrifying journey that she herself has to make, that the main character has to make, so that as glib as she is and as smart-assy as she is, like my other two characters in my other books, my main protagonist, she breaks down. She has to break down at some point, and not just break down and have a showy sort of demise psychologically, but she has to really, as you say, enter the underworld and come back out again and return to the place, if possible, where she was. I don't know if she does do that. That sounds a little bit too pat.
She goes pretty far, though.
But she goes pretty far. It's not clear. I mean, nothing is resolved by the end of the book, but I mean, she does go pretty far.
Well, what you see, what I would say is that the book begins with a belief that a certain kind of brutal humor and irony will sustain it.
Yes.
And that in the course of writing the book, something better came along as an option for
you. I think
you,
that's right.
As an option for a writer.
Right.
That's deeper than irony.
Right.
And that the book opened up.
With, yeah, exactly.
With the possibilities of compassion, but more the possibility of madness, of breakdown, of grief, that something was freed.
Right.
And that brought this character to a stage deeper than your other characters had been.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookworm. This is my guest, Carol Muskie Dukes. I'm Michael Silverblatt. What we have here is Boyd, who is slowly returning to a calling as an obstetrician, meeting the man who does most of the embalming for the funeral home that embalmed her husband. In other words, a confrontation between the keeper of the door of life and the keeper of the door of death. And she is in a room that has four corpses. She begins to look at one of them. She's there with Griggs because she has certain crucial things to ask him about her husband's death. This is Carol Muskie Dukes reading from Life After Death.
She couldn't help herself. She laughed at last, a little wildly. Griggs shook his head gently, reprovingly. Dr. Schaefer, we're not here for your amusement. Boyd struggled not to laugh again. It was difficult, not because anything was funny, but because of the enormous feeling of portentousness in this room. Boyd looked closer at the bodies. What did they remind her of? Then it came to her. They all looked like the just born. They had the same aura of the other world, the wrapped in light, washed up on the shore aura. They were on the other side, the side she touched when she pulled a baby from a womb. I would like to know, she said, what you do here. Griggs nodded, reached out and patted the right hand of the woman who lay before them. He reached up and flicked off the music, then picked up the dead woman's hand again. He gently set the hand on her chest and began to ready a tray of instruments near the gleaming sink to his left. People tend to die ugly. It's a sad fact. But people are beautiful, you see, one-of-a-kind beautiful. Okay, so, granted it is, this thing I do done for someone who ends up lying in a coffin, lying in the ground, but that doesn't matter. If the look's restored, if that one exact look is brought back for just a little peek, that's enough. I admit that it's done for the living, too, for just as long as it takes for the ones left behind to see and remember, because what they see lasts forever. As he chatted, he opened a large bottle of liquid. He pursed his lips and blew into metal tubes that Boyd recognized as cannula tubes, the kind used to instill dye or fluid into the uterus. She watched him transfixed. "Anyway, I can do these things," he said. "I have that gift." He looked at the dead woman with tenderness. "In front of you is Mrs. Lillian Sturzel. She died in her kitchen of a cerebral aneurysm, a brain hemorrhage, as you know." Boyd found her voice. "She looks like she... Yeah, she looks like she was sick a long time, don't she? But she wasn't. She was just old a long time. She only wanted cherry popsicles at the end. Mrs. Sturzel, Lillian, was a little senile, you see. Her daughter told me that she was living way back in her childhood, when she ate ice cream on sticks all summer. Lillian was a widow a long time. Arthur Sturzel passed through my hands, too." He turned and placed a smaller tray of instruments on the table to his left. "What are you doing?" He looked into her eyes, a steep, unfathomable look. "I'm sorry. I have to proceed with my work now."
Carol Muskie-Duke's reading from Life After Death. Now, it's my sense that scenes like that began, as you said, in the Evelyn Waugh loved one joy boy mold. But it seems to me that in the course of writing the book, you discovered something more unusual. That had to do not exactly with compassion, but with what?
What I did when I did research for this novel was I went, the novel is set in Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota originally. I went back to visit, and I, through a family connection, I was able to visit a mortuary. And I saw people, or bodies, people's bodies, you know, being treated, embalmed, and so on. Hmm. And I was fascinated. And I thought, why is it that we keep the dead so far from us? Why is it that we don't touch the dead? Why is it that we don't want to? I'm not saying that there's anything we should be ghoulish. I don't think that we have to, you know, spend our lives, you know, thinking about the dead. But I think that we do ostracize the dead. We banish the dead. And I felt very much that the dead, you're going to think I sound crazy here, but that they longed for company, that there was a kind of communication going on. Obviously, the novel, I mean, it's obvious to me anyway, having written it, that the novel is about the communication between the dead and the living anyway. And Hardy, I think I was telling you, Thomas Hardy says somewhere that writers, through writing, the conversation between the dead and the living goes on. And he lost his wife, obviously, and wrote those incredible poems about her and to her and speaking with her. So I found that I began to believe that as well. In the course of writing the novel, I believed that we needed to have more empathy for the dead, that we needed to converse with the dead. I will go so far as to say that. And in the book, in fact, that does happen. Boyd does communicate with her husband, and she sees him, in fact, after he dies. And it's, but I wished for it not to be a kind of, you know, Hollywood version of, you know, the return of Patrick Swayze or whoever it was, but you know, I wanted it to be an actual, if possible, credible in quotes, encounter.
Now, in ways that you could not at all have expected or wanted, did the book prepare you for a conversation with death and with the dead?
As far as preparing me for the actual shock of the death, no, because I think that the shock is so enormous and so hard to describe and so hard to imagine if you haven't lived through it. The shock, the numbness, the vertigo, the plummeting feeling of absolute disorientation. Where am I in the world? Who am I in the world now? How is it possible this person is no longer in the world? Those feelings, I think, I would say that I did not in any way, could not have prepared myself for by writing the book.
Then a final question. Do you think that there is a way that writing can help you with unbearable, unexpectable experience? Does writing have that trick up its sleeve?
Well, I don't know if it's a trick, but when I was talking about empathy for the dead, I was thinking that, and Hardy's quote about continuing to converse with the dead through writing, that, I think that writing allows, I have thanked God that I'm a writer since David died, because I feel that it has sustained me. Not only that, it has, I was talking to Louise Glick about this, who is also, as you know, writes on these themes brilliantly, and I said it doesn't comfort one to write poems, let's say, about what has happened, but it clarifies. It does clarify, and in that white light, one is released in a way from a certain burden, the white light of that clarification process.
In other words, not the white light of the tunnel that one goes through.
No, not the white light of the tunnel. That's why I'd like to go back to the irony and the satire. No,
right.
Not that white light.
The white light of the flooding of light, the spotlight,
yes,
on the situation.
On the situation.
Putting it in a harsh light.
Exactly. Or even maybe not so much harsh as just a surgical sort of light, you know, and maybe a light similar to one that you would see in an embalming chamber, whatever, or a surgery theater. But I felt I couldn't write at all right after David died, and I couldn't even read, really, or listen to music. But then gradually I could read and I could listen to music. And then after maybe 2 or 3 months, a flood of poems came to me. And they really seemed to have been processing themselves, you know, thinking themselves through, because they came, I don't want to put too romantic a spin on this, but they really came to me almost whole. That has not been my experience previously in writing poetry. So I feel as if that process was going on, that examination process was going on, and I found it very sustaining.
I've been speaking to Carol Muskie-Dukes about her most recent novel, Life After Death. It's published by Random House. It's a book, as you see, that moves through poles from a kind of hilarious coldness to great emotional intensity. And I think the trip between those poles is one that we take throughout our lives. I was very happy to have read this book, and thank you for joining me, Carol.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse, Mouse.